Coming up on Weekend America.
Pete McCloskey was an anti-war Republican running against Richard Nixon.
I had no chance. The Republican sentiments at that time thought I was... they almost thought I was a traitor.
But at the 1972 convention, he did get one delegate. We meet McCloskey and that delegate. I'm John Moe. Also this hour, it's a three-day weekend, but for more and more Americans, that's nothing special.
In reality, the 30 minutes extra a day isn't really that much longer after you're already going. It really pays off. I'd rather go 30 minutes extra any day than have to go on the Monday.
The rise of the four-day week. And Katrina hit the Gulf Coast 3 years ago, but the aftermath continues.
Yeah. You have flashbacks of what was, and you look back where your house was. It's not near anymore, and... it's a sinking feeling.
Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. We hope you're enjoying your Labor Day weekend, doing some relaxing. This hour, we'll meet someone who isn't relaxing at all. She's writing a novel. There's an international three-day novel writing contest going on, and authors have Labor Day weekend, just Labor Day weekend, to produce a masterpiece. No pressure. So we're going to bug one of the authors live, mid-process, and ask how it's going. Should be kind of a tense interview, really. Also, we tour Biloxi 3 years after Katrina and take a strange flight out of Puerto Rico. What are you doing this weekend?
I'm golfing. Last chance before big rains and fall. It's in the air.
This weekend for Labor Day, we're having cookout at our house with family.
I just discovered it's Labor Day weekend.
This weekend, it's my dad's birthday.
I am probably going to plant some plants in my garden.
I am going to Gig Harbor with family. We're having a giant salmon bake.
Working farmers markets. Well, we bring fresh berries to markets in the Seattle area from our farm and sell it to the public.
Ah, I think I've had those berries. I just got homesick. Those voices came from San Diego, Kirkland, Washington, and Tampa, Florida. Well, here in St. Paul, we're getting ready to have company over. Lots and lots of company. John McCain, Sarah Palin, loads of other Republicans, and approximately 5 billion members of the media. It's the Republican National Convention just down the street from our studio. Delegates will be casting their votes and nominating the McCain-Palin ticket. Political conventions tend to be well-choreographed affairs. Delegates are expected to unite behind the candidate, since any dissension could be seen as politically toxic. This was the case in 1972 as well, when the Republicans were united behind Richard Nixon. Well, almost united. Weekend America's Susie Lechtenberg has the story.
Pete McCloskey has a cartoon pinned to the wall in his office in Redwood City, California. It's a drawing of a skeleton.
Well, he's holding up a wreath or a scythe or something, and he's a death figure.
The skeleton holds a sign that says 1,347 votes for Nixon, one vote for peace. At the Republican National Convention in Miami Beach in 1972, Richard Nixon won 1,347 delegate votes. That one vote for peace, that was for Pete McCloskey. McCloskey was a Republican congressman from California when he ran for president. He'd won two Purple Hearts as a Marine lieutenant in the Korean War. He was incensed by the war in Vietnam. And did he think he had a chance?
I had no chance. The Republican sentiments at that time thought I was... they almost thought I was a traitor.
McCloskey hoped his anti-war message would embarrass Nixon. He campaigned hard, but vowed if he didn't get enough votes in the New Hampshire primary, he would give up.
Good evening from ABC News headquarters in Washington. I'm Howard K. Smith.
I'm Harry Reasoner in New York. Representative McCloskey withdraws his bid for the Republican presidential nomination.
Most candidates lose a primary, drop out, and it's over. But that wasn't the case for Pete McCloskey. In New Mexico, a Republican named Tom Mayer and his mom were disappointed that their anti-war candidate had dropped out. And so they got him back on the ballot for the primary in their state. Pete McCloskey won enough votes to earn one delegate. He chose Tom Mayer.
I agreed to do it, and that was when all the troubles began.
McCloskey and Mayer hatched a grand plan. At the convention, when Mayer cast his one delegate vote, he would give a speech. It would broadcast live, and it would be scathing. Mayer would renounce Nixon and the war.
I thought I'll have to, this is going to take some serious work to write a speech that does what you want done, which is derogatory of Nixon as it should be, and still reasonably dignified. And also, yeah, I had every intention of saying a number of nice things about McCloskey, too.
Republican leadership caught wind of McCloskey and Mayer's plan. It didn't go over well. And in a flash, Pete McCloskey was assigned a new delegate, and Tom Mayer's speech was dashed.
We had a lot of laughs. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, we were going to live or die if we didn't succeed by making a speech down there. But you have to laugh at the pomposity of the Republican leadership in those days. And I think Tom and I had a few laughs about trying to prick the elephant in its tender parts.
McCloskey and Mayer decided to go to Miami Beach to the convention anyway. In their words, to raise a little bit of hell.
The Republican convention will reach its climax tonight, both inside and outside the convention hall. Inside, the delegates will hear Richard M. Nixon accept his party's nomination for the second term. Outside, peace demonstrators will stage their main event of the week.
On a sweltering August afternoon, over 1,000 Vietnam veterans, dressed in their battle fatigues, marched outside of the hotel where the National Press was staying. Riot-equipped Florida law enforcement lined the streets to block them.
I remember Pete coming, he said, I want to see this. Well, we go over there, and what is the tensest thing short of actual combat I've ever seen in my life.
I saw what was happening, and Tom and I edged our way through this line of policemen. And I'll tell you, those policemen weren't looking forward to a war with Vietnam vets, and you could sense them kind of shaking.
The situation was volatile, but Pete McCloskey had an idea, mediate. McCloskey introduced himself to the anti-war leaders and to the police. He was able to calm things down. Miraculously, a riot didn't erupt, and the protest dispersed, peacefully. McCloskey and Mayer returned to their hotel rooms exhausted, drained from the heat and from the tension.
A fine ending into a disastrous campaign.
Pete McCloskey is the kind of person who seems to bounce back from a deflated presidential run in a good-humored sort of way. After his loss, he was a Republican congressman until 1983. He co-authored the Endangered Species Act and launched the first Earth Day. But the election in 1972 had the inverse effect on Tom Mayer. After it was over, he started living part of the year in Mexico. He was disillusioned with America and with the political process and wanted distance.
I've never been able to work up any enthusiasm for a candidate since. And I probably shouldn't say this on national public radio, but I've just not voted. I thought people who think that they can change things by going into public life are out of their minds. Damn fools.
Pete McCloskey still believes there's opportunity for change in the political process. Change he now hopes to make from the other side of the aisle. Last year, after almost 60 years as a Republican, he registered as a Democrat. Corruption in the Republican Party, he says, was the final straw. Pete McCloskey is now 80 years old, and he's a farmer in Northern California. He raises oranges and pecans and grows olives to make olive oil. And he finds joy outside of politics.
Well, I'll tell you, I love being a farmer. I feel like a pretty big guy when I get up on that John Deere tractor and hoeing around my orange trees or my olive trees. It's like Thomas Jefferson, he enjoyed being a farmer, I think, a lot more than he did being president.
In Los Angeles, I'm Susie Lechtenberg for Weekend America.
You can see a photo of Tom Mayer, the delegate, at our website, weekendamerica.org. Well, it is a three-day weekend for many Americans. That means an extra day to hit the beach one more time, maybe go to the state fair, have one last food served on a stick. But more and more Americans are experiencing three-day weekends from a non-vacation perspective. An increasing number of towns and cities, even school districts, are adopting four-day weeks in an effort to curb energy use. It means longer days at the office, working four 10-hour days a lot of the time. But there is that one extra day off. We wanted to check in with these three-day weekenders. We begin in Winchester, Massachusetts, with Mary Ellen Lannan.
The town of Winchester did an experiment this summer where we closed our offices on Friday and worked a four-day work week. And we did that for eight consecutive weeks. And the end of the program has just completed, and I think it was a success. I have two boys and a girl, and so having Fridays off for me personally was a nice opportunity. The kids were able to do some tennis lessons with our recreation department, and having Fridays meant that I could be the mom that got to sit in the bleachers and watch my children play tennis, which was a fun thing for me because typically I'm always at work. I think Americans are just too rushed, and I know I really did feel relaxed. I think it helps when people have a little bit more time on their hands. I mean, we're definitely putting the hours in. The hours are there, but it's just in a different way of thinking about it.
I'm James Gagos. I'm the superintendent of schools of Cimarron Municipal School District. And Cimarron is a rural community of about 850 people in northeastern New Mexico. Since about 1973, Cimarron Municipal Schools has been on a four-day school week. I think the teachers have pretty much come into it that that's what they want is a four-day week. And I think I kind of joke about this, that you have to wait for either somebody to die or to retire to get a job here. Child care has mostly been taken care of by families. By aunts, uncles, brothers, sisters, grandparents. So having that three-day weekend gives, kids and families a chance in the wintertime to take advantage of all of those areas in our state.
The day that the mayor proposed a four-day work week, we were all in a staff meeting. The chief of staff came in, and they were telling us that he had some concerns about, he knew some of the employees were having like a little hardship at the pump. The excitement in the room was just, wow, amazing. Everybody was excited about it. Of course, some people were not able to participate because some of them have small children. But for myself, it was a blessing in disguise. It takes me about 20 minutes to get to work. And I think I saved roughly a week. I think I saved like $28 a week I'm saving in gas. So I see the difference in that. It's really good because it does give me time to do some of my hobbies, some of the things that makes me feel relaxed as opposed to being at work and, you know, things can get hectic, you get stressed and pushed for time. But being able to be at home that extra day and just relax and just kick your feet up and pig out on your favorite food and snacks, I love it.
Mary Ellen Lannan from Winchester, Massachusetts, James Gallegos from Cimarron, New Mexico, and Carolyn Johnson-Turner from Birmingham, Alabama.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Barack Obama packs thousands into a football stadium in Denver. John McCain flies one person in from Alaska. Good news, bad news, no news at all. Next on Weekend America. It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. Well, August is normally a slow time in news cycles, not a lot happening, a lot of people on vacation, a lot of laying around in the sun. But this year it's been a little busier. It's been a little intense. There's political conventions, the campaign coming up, news all over. How do you make sense of it? Well, you tune into Weekend America to sort it into good news, bad news, or no news at all. See, it all makes sense now. Here's Weekend America's Bill Radke.
Thanks, John. With us this week, our writer-comedian Dana Gould. Hey, Dana.
How are you?
Great, thank you. Columnist and author Dan Savage. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Bill.
And I'd like to remind our female listeners that this segment has always included at least one woman panelist. At least.
Some weeks it was me, though.
For some weeks it was Dan Savage.
You are that Dan Savage.
It's been something we've always been committed to. Yale literature professor Amy Hungerford, you honor us all.
Present and female.
Howard Dean keeps calling me, telling me our first topic has to be the Democratic convention, but that'll have to wait a few moments because the morning after the convention, Republican John McCain chose as his running mate Alaska Governor Sarah Palin. Is this good news, bad news, or no news?
It's good news for the Pumas, who attracted so much attention to themselves at the Democratic National Convention, mm-hmm. to the people who believe that sexism and not rank incompetence cost Hillary Clinton the nomination. Mm. They don't care. They're saying they're going to vote for McCain, even though he's diametrically opposed to everything Hillary Clinton stands for. And now with a lady on the ticket, I think it's good news for John McCain.
I think it's bad news for John McCain. I mean, as soon as you realize exactly how old John McCain is and how serious it is to have as a vice president a true lightweight from what I can see of her so far, she just really seems to be someone I would be scared to have as the president or a heartbeat away from the president.
You know, clearly it's a very blatant, ham-handed attempt to lure away the disaffected Clinton voters. But the last night of the Democratic convention, I think, did a lot to bring them back into the fold. I would say that a lot of those women joined the Mile High Club.
I don't think, you know, sexist humor is necessarily going to attract those Clinton voters back, but I'm with you. I think they joined the Mile High Club, too.
Is it good news whenever one of the parties puts someone other than a white male on its ticket?
Yes. It's great that, you know, there is a African-American and a woman both on the tickets or both. That's great. And what they said was true. Like, you know, because of Hillary Clinton, it is now no longer inconceivable that a woman can be president.
I am worried by the idea that women get appointed when they're clearly incapable of doing the thing they're being appointed to do. Instead of someone like Elizabeth Dole who has substance, there are a lot of women like that out there. What does this say about the way women are conceived in the public sphere of politics, that you bring one on board for the purposes, the political purposes of the man in charge, and you specifically don't choose someone who is a strong person with an experienced take on things.
Okay, what about that convention? You watched it. You knew I was going to ask you. Where was the good, bad, and no news?
The good was, you know, if this Obama guy loses, I think in 4 years, somebody stepped forward at this convention and really clearly established themselves on the national stage as someone with vision and passion, very articulate. His name's John Kerry. He's a senator from Massachusetts. I don't know where he was 4 years ago, but his speech to the Democratic convention the other night was amazing.
It shows you what can happen when handlers and consultants and the party strangle a candidate.
The same handlers and consultants who strangled Gore were all working on the Clinton campaign.
Paradoxically, especially as an English professor who is interested in eloquence, I think the good news for Obama was that he was not too eloquent. I think the risk in that stadium was that he would go to that high-flown language that he loves and that, honestly, I love, and that it would sound too much at this early moment in the national campaign. And I think he played that line very well. He was a little more restrained, and I think the venue, along with that restraint, put him forward in just the right light.
Our next topic, 9-year-old Jericho Scott is a good little league pitcher. In fact, he is too good. He throws so hard that the Youth Baseball League of New Haven, Connecticut says he can't pitch anymore. He's never hit a batter, but his fastball is scaring the other children. Would forcing him off the mound be good news, bad news, or no news?
Bad news.
How's that?
That's part of what organized athletics are about. He shouldn't be penalized for being skilled. You know, if he's a terrifying pitcher and he's on a team that wins lots of games because he's a really terrific little pitcher, well, that's just the way the, you know, little league cookie crumbles.
I want to take issue with Dan's language and the language that I've heard swirling about this. Nothing against my great fellow New Haven citizens, but the language in which this is cast as penalizing him for being good just seems completely wrong to me. Isn't this about, here's a kid who is at a level far higher than everybody else he's playing with. Since when is it a bad thing to ask a kid to be challenged, to move into another league where he will actually play with people who are as good as he is? Why isn't everybody talking about what's best for this kid? Why aren't those the terms of the conversation? I don't understand this. This is punishment for him being too good.
Dan, what about these arguments that, you know, just ease up? This is supposed to be about fun.
Well, I'm not going to defend organized child athletics as, you know, a little sissy boy who ran screaming from a ball that was thrown at me faster than 3 miles an hour. However, I don't think you can have, you know, one standard for everybody else in the league, which is play your hardest, and another for this other kid.
Our final topic. Scientists have long thought that our mental abilities naturally start collapsing around 5 years before we die. A new study suggests it might happen much sooner, more like 15 years before the end. Does this strike you as good news, bad news, or no news?
It's good news for John McCain.
For me personally, this is terrible news because my mother beats me in Scrabble almost every time we play. Mm-hmm. And if she